Chapter 17. In the Land of Pocahontas. 1 month after filming ended for the last home run, we said goodbye to West Palm Beach. There had been two more murders within a block of our home, but in the end, it was clutter, not crime, that drove us from our little bungalow on Churchill Road. With two children and all the accoutrements that went with them, we were packed to the rafters. Besides, Jenny was now working half-time for the post-feature section, and mostly from home, as she attempted to juggle children and career. It only made sense for us to relocate closer to my office. Life is full of little ironies, and one of them was the fact that after months of searching, we settled on a house in the one South Florida city I took the greatest glee in publicly ridiculing. That place was Boca Raton, which translated from the Spanish means Mouth of the Rat. Boca Raton was a wealthy Republican bastion largely populated with recent arrivals from New Jersey and New York. Most of the money in town was new money, and most of those who had it didn't know how to enjoy it without making fools of themselves. Boca Raton was a land of luxury sedans, red sports cars, pink stucco mansions crammed onto postage stamp lots. The city crawled with plastic surgeons, and they had the biggest homes and most radiant smiles of all. The younger women all had magnificent boob jobs. The older women all had magnificent boob jobs and facelifts. Butt sculpting, nose jobs, tummy tucks, and tattooed mascara rounded out the cosmetic lineup, giving the city's female population the odd appearance of being foot soldiers in an army of anatomically correct inflatable dolls. In my column, I had been poking fun at the Boca lifestyle. The Disney movie Pocahontas was in the theaters then, and I launched a running spoof on the Indian princess theme, which I titled Pocahontas. My gold-draped protagonist was an indigenous suburban princess who drove a pink BMW, her rock-hard, surgically enhanced breasts jutting into the steering wheel, allowing her to drive hands-free, talking on her cell phone and teasing her frosted hair in the rear-view mirror as she raced to the tanning salon. Pocahontas spent her afternoon stalking wild furs, trusty Amex card in hand, at the ceremonial hunting grounds known as Town Center Mall. So it only made sense that when Jenny and I finally settled on a house, it was located midway between the waterfront estates of East Boca Raton and the snooty gated communities of West Boca Raton. Our new neighborhood was in one of the few middle-class sections in the city, and its residents liked to joke with a certain reverse snobbery that they were on the wrong side of both sets of tracks. Sure enough, there were two sets of railroad tracks, one defining the eastern boundary of the neighborhood and one the western. My paper, the Sun Sentinel, was the dominant newspaper in Boca Raton, and because my photograph appeared above my column, I was frequently recognized. "We can't move to Boca. I'll be run out of town on a rail. They'll serve my head up on a bed of organic mescaline greens." But we had been looking for months, and this was the first house that met all our criteria. It was the right size at the right price and in the right place, strategically located between the two offices where I split my time. The public schools were about as good as public schools got in South Florida. The barbarian was about to slip inside the gate. When we first arrived, I slinked around town self-consciously, convinced all eyes were on me. My ears burned, imagining people were whispering as I passed. After I wrote a column welcoming myself to the neighborhood and eating a fair amount of crow in the process, I received a number of letters saying things like, "You trash our city and now you want to live here? What a shameless hypocrite." I had to admit, they made a point. I soon discovered, however, that most of my neighbors here on the wrong side of both sets of tracks were sympathetic to my written assaults on what one of them called the gauche and vulgar among us. Pretty soon, I felt right at home. Our house was a 1970s vintage four-bedroom ranch with twice the square footage of our first home and none of the charm. The place had potential, though, and gradually we put our mark on it. I slowly turned the bereft front yard into a tropical garden teeming with gingers and heliconias and passion vines that butterflies and passers-by alike stopped to drink in. The two best features of our new home had nothing to do with the house itself. Visible from our living room window was a small city park filled with playground equipment beneath towering pines. The children adored it. And in the backyard, right off the new French doors, was an in-ground swimming pool. We hadn't wanted a pool, worrying about the risk to our two toddlers. Our first act on the day we moved in was to surround the pool with a 4-foot-high fence worthy of a maximum security prison. The boys, Patrick had just turned 3 and Connor 18 months when we arrived, took to the water like a pair of dolphins. A swimming pool in Florida, we soon learned, made the difference between barely enduring the withering summer months and actually enjoying them. No one loved the backyard pool more than our water dog, that proud descendant of fishermen's retrievers plying the ocean swells off the coast of Newfoundland. If the pool gate was open, Marley would charge for the water, getting a running start from the family room, going airborne out the open French doors, and with one bounce off the brick patio, landing in the pool on his belly with a giant flop that sent a geyser into the air and waves over the edge. One thing our new house did not have was a Marley-proof bunker. The garage had no windows and was stiflingly hot. Besides, it was finished in drywall, not concrete, which Marley had already proved himself quite adept at pulverizing. His thunder-induced panic attacks were only getting worse, despite the tranquilizers. The first time we left him alone in our new house, we shut him in the laundry room, just off the kitchen, with a blanket and a big bowl of water. When we returned a few hours later, he had scratched up the door. The damage was minor, but we knew it didn't bode well. "There's not even a cloud in the sky," Jenny observed skeptically. "What's going to happen the first time a storm hits?" The next time we left him alone, we found out. As thunderheads rolled in, we cut our outing short and hurried home, but it was too late. Jenny was a few steps ahead of me, and when she opened the laundry room door, she stopped short and uttered, "Oh my God." She said it the way you would if you had just discovered a body hanging from the chandelier. I peeked in over her shoulder, and it was uglier than I had feared. Marley was standing there, panting frantically, his paws and mouth bleeding. Loose fur was everywhere, as though the thunder had scared the hair right out of his coat. An entire wall was gouged open, obliterated clear down to the studs. Plaster and wood chips and bent nails were everywhere. Electric wiring lay exposed. Blood smeared the floor and the walls. It looked literally like the scene of a shotgun homicide. Oh my God. It was all either of us could say. After several seconds of just standing there mute, staring at the carnage, I finally said, "Okay, we can handle this. It's all fixable." Jenny shot me her look. She had seen my repairs. "I'll call a drywall guy and have it professionally repaired," I said. "A few $100 and we'll be good as new," she chirped. Within a few minutes, Marley was beginning to mellow. His eyelids grew heavy and his eyes deeply bloodshot, as they always did when he was doped up. I always resisted sedating him, but the pills helped him move past the terror, past the deadly threat that existed only in his mind. If he were human, I would call him certifiably psychotic. He was delusional, paranoid, convinced a dark evil force was coming from the heavens to take him. He curled up on the rug in front of the kitchen sink and let out a deep sigh. I knelt beside him and stroked his blood-caked fur. Without lifting his head, he looked up at me with those bloodshot, stoner eyes of his, the saddest, most mournful eyes I have ever seen. It was as if he were trying to tell me something, something important he needed me to understand. "I know," I said. "I know you can't help it." The next day, Jenny and I took the boys with us to the pet store and bought a giant cage. They came in all different sizes, and when I described Marley to the clerk, he led us to the largest of them all. It was enormous, big enough for a lion to stand up and turn around in. Made out of heavy steel grating, it had two bolt-action barrel locks to hold the door securely shut, and a heavy steel pan for a floor. This was our answer, our own portable Alcatraz. Connor and Patrick both crawled inside, and I slid the bolts shut, locking them in for a moment. "What do you guys think?" I asked. "Will this hold our superdog?" "Waddy's going to be our prisoner," Patrick shrieked, delighted at the prospect. Back home, we set up the crate next to the washing machine. Portable Alcatraz took up nearly half the laundry room. "Come here, Marley," I called. I tossed a milk bone in, and he happily pranced in after it. I closed and bolted the door behind him, and he stood there chewing his treat, unfazed by the new life experience he was about to enter, the one known in mental health circles as involuntary commitment. "This is going to be your new home when we're away," I said cheerfully. Marley stood there panting contentedly, not a trace of concern on his face, and then he lay down and let out a sigh. A good sign. A very good sign. That evening, we decided to give the maximum security dog containment unit a test run. This time, I didn't even need a milk bone to lure Marley in. I simply opened the gate, gave a whistle, and in he walked, tail banging the metal sides. As we loaded the boys into the minivan to go out to dinner, Jenny said, "You know something? This is the first time since we got him that I don't have a pit in my stomach leaving Marley alone in the house." "Yeah, it was always a guessing game. What will our dog destroy this time?" "I think that crate is going to be the best money we ever spent." We had a great dinner out, followed by a sunset stroll on the beach. The boys splashed in the surf. Just knowing Marley was safely secured inside Alcatraz, unable to hurt himself or anything else, was a balm. "What a nice outing this has been," Jenny said, as we walked up the front sidewalk to our house. I was about to agree with her when I noticed something in my peripheral vision. Something up ahead that wasn't quite right. I turned my head and stared at the window beside the front door. The mini blinds were shut, as they always were when we left the house. But about a foot up from the bottom of the window, the metal slats were bent apart and something was sticking through them. Something black and wet and pressed up against the glass. What the... Marley? When I opened the front door, sure enough, there was our one dog welcoming committee, wiggling all over the foyer, pleased as punch to have us home again. We converged on the laundry room. The crate's door stood wide open, swung back like the stone to Jesus' tomb on Easter morning. I squatted down beside the cage to have a closer look. The two bolt-action barrel locks were slid back in the open position, and, a significant clue, they were dripping with saliva. It looks like an inside job. "I can't believe it," Jenny said. Then she uttered a word I was glad the children were not close enough to hear. We always fancied Marley to be as dumb as Algy, but he had been clever enough to figure out how to use his long, strong tongue through the bars to slowly work the barrels free from their slots. We took to wiring both locks in place with heavy electrical cable. That worked for a while, but one day, with distant rumbles on the horizon, we came home to find that the bottom corner of the cage's gate had been peeled back as though with a giant can opener, and a panicky Marley, his paws again bloodied, was firmly stuck around the ribcage, half in and half out of the tight opening. I bent the steel gate back in place as best I could, and we began wiring not only the slide bolts in place, but all four corners of the door as well. Pretty soon, we were reinforcing the corners of the cage itself as Marley continued to put his brawn into busting out. Within 3 months, the gleaming steel cage we had thought so impregnable looked like it had taken a direct hit from a howitzer. The bars were twisted and bent, the frame pried apart, the door an ill-fitting mess, the sides bulging outward. I continued to reinforce it as best I could, and it continued to hold tenuously against Marley's full-bodied assaults. Whatever false sense of security the contraption had once offered us was gone. Each time we left, even for a half hour, we wondered whether this would be the time that our manic inmate would bust out and go on another couch-shredding, wall-gouging, door-eating rampage. So much for peace of mind.